Whether you're shopping for grads, getting an early gift for dad, or just looking for a little something new or used for your shelf, you'll find it at HPB. And you'll get almost everything for an extra 20% off during the big sale at Half Price Books this Memorial Day weekend. Saturday, May 25th through Monday, May 27th, save big in-store at your local Half Price Books and at HPB.com. Offer cannot be combined with other coupons. Exclusions apply. To learn more, visit HPB.com.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, добро пожаловать в Prevail. Это второй сезон нашей борьбы с криминальными сволочами. Ваш ведущий Грег О'Леари.
I'm Грег О'Леари. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. Thanks to BetterHelp for supporting Prevail. For 10% off your first month, go to BetterHelp, that's HELP.com/Greg. Start living a better life today. We've got a great show. My friend Zarina Zabriskie is here. We're going to talk about Ukraine, the situation in Ukraine, what Vladimir Putin is doing, why he's doing what he's doing, and how the heck we're going to get out of it. As I'm recording this, it's Groundhog Day. It's Wednesday at 5:30. When I woke up this morning, trending on Twitter were the words Germany and Poland. And those three words in concert like that do not really cheer me up in terms of, are we going to avoid a third world war? It really got me thinking, and talking to Zarina got me thinking, because she says in the interview that Putin is basically using the Nazi German playbook or the Goebbels playbook in a lot of cases in terms of the disinformation campaigns and that. But it also, it seems to me, in what he's doing and how he's running the country. And I mapped it out and I wrote about this morning. And there's a lot of similarities between Hitler and Putin in terms of just surface stuff. I mean, I don't want to get too cute with the comparison, because everybody, you know, it's the first rule of the internet is everybody we don't like, we compare to Hitler. But the parallels, and I think Putin is, you know, is a student of history and has watched this and knows what he's doing. He has studied from other strongmen. That's what strongmen do. They watch each other and they learn and they apply what they learn. If you look at the parallels between the rise of Putin, how he consolidated power in Russia, and his imperial designs and how he's gone about expanding, the parallels to what Hitler did are alarming. January 1933, Adolf Hitler becomes Chancellor of Germany. The president, Paul von Hindenburg, is kind of a relic from an earlier era, different generation, remains the face of the country. August 1999. Vladimir Putin becomes acting prime minister of Russia. The president, Boris Yeltsin, older, relic of a different generation, remains the face of the country. February 1933, a fire destroys the Reichstag building. Hitler blames the communists, although he's pretty much clearly responsible. He uses this as a pretext to seize more power. 1999, a series of apartment bombings terrorize Moscow. Putin blames the Chechen separatists, although we all kind of know that he and his allies are responsible. He uses this as a pretext to seize more power. March 1933, the Enabling Act gives Hitler dictatorial powers, effectively ending democracy in Germany. He'll remain in power until his death in 1945. December 1999, Putin is named acting president, the first step toward ending democracy in Russia. He's been in power ever since. June 1934. To consolidate power, Hitler orders the execution of his political rivals in what is later called the Night of the Long Knives. October and November 2006. To consolidate power, Putin almost certainly orders the execution of his rivals, including the investigative journalist Anna Politkovskaya and former FSB organized crime task force head Alexander Litvinenko. This is 3 years after the humiliating trial and imprisonment of Russia's wealthiest oligarch, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, gives the other oligarchs pause about crossing Putin. August 1936, Germany hosts the Olympic Games, just kind of a diplomatic coup for Hitler. February 2014, Russia hosts the Olympic Games, kind of a diplomatic coup for Putin. March 1938, Germany occupies and then annexes Austria. There's a little outcry in the West. February 2014, Russia occupies and then annexes Crimea. There's a little outcry in the West. September, October 1938, claiming that German-speaking citizens in the Sudetenland region of Czechoslovakia are being mistreated by the Prague government, Germany occupies the Sudetenland. The Allied powers, led by British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, decide to appease Hitler, allowing him to keep the territory in exchange for a promise not to invade Poland. Hitler begins amassing troops along the Polish border. 2014 to present, claiming that Russian-speaking citizens in the Donbas region of Ukraine are being mistreated by the Kyiv government, Russia infiltrates the region with the obvious objective of finding a pretext to invade. Putin begins amassing troops on the Ukrainian border. That's where things sit today. Now, in the case of Hitler in 1938, it took a year, he invaded Poland, started World War II, lots of really, really bad things happened. We don't know what Putin's going to do, and again, I don't want to suggest at all that these are two guys that are the same. I think their motivations are different. Hitler is obviously uniquely evil, and Putin is a crook. You know, he's a fucking criminal that just wants money. He's a cold-blooded, crooked mob boss, basically. I think their motivations are different. But obviously, the parallels here are alarming and have to be taken seriously. And so far, it looks like, thank goodness, President Biden is doing just that. And I don't know how this is going to end. It's scary. And, you know, you appease this guy, it's just going to get worse. To not appease him, of course, is also not great. You know, hopefully these, again, Biden is threatened through Blinken, Secretary of State, major economic sanctions, pain on Russia if Putin continues or invades Ukraine. We'll see if that happens. I think that, you know, Biden knows who this guy is. He said it, right? I looked into his soul. I saw he had no soul. I know we have a lot of things on our mind here in the United States. Between the pandemic and the insurrection and Trump's continued attempt to overthrow the government and install himself there and all the enablers and lackeys that are going along with it, it's terrifying. Things are going on in Canada that are weird right now. I don't even know what's going on there. We're going to investigate that maybe next week. But for this one episode, I really want to pull back and look at what's going on in Ukraine. So no one better to have on than Zarina Zbrisky. Grew up in the Soviet Union, went to the same college that Putin went to, took combat propaganda. If you've read her interview with me on Prevail or listened to the podcast here before, you know all this. She knows her stuff. you know, she came to the United States soon after graduating, has been here ever since. She's a writer, a novelist, a short story writer, brilliant person. And, you know, she's done a lot of journalism and was in Ukraine a couple months ago. She spent, I think, about a month in Ukraine and mostly in Odessa. So she, you know, her feet were on the ground. And I think she has a unique viewpoint into what's happening. So we're going to talk to her and try to get to the bottom of what's going on. We'll be right back with Zarina Zabriskie. Do you ever get nostalgic about the good old days?
The days when girls were girls and men were men, and the woke mob hadn't come for our pronouns.
A time when America was, dare I say, great. Hi, I'm Rex Tillerson.
And I'm Betsy DeVos.
And we're here to tell you about a new music collection from Time Life Music, the MAGA years, 2016 to 2020.
This collection of 38 compact discs is the soundtrack of the best years of our lives. It includes hits from your favorite artists, bands like Mara LaGogo's, Bigley and the Great Agains, and School of Priebus. It takes you right back, doesn't it, Rex?
It sure does, Betsy. There's so many memorable hits. Who can forget Dancing with Your Sweetheart to Russia Help Find the 30,000 Emails, or watching the big game while No Collusion played on the jukebox? And then there's my own personal favorite, Lock Her Up.
Well, you're in luck, Rex. One entire compact disc is just different covers of Lock Her Up.
Oh, that's amazing, Betsy. The good folks at Time Life Books know exactly what we want to hear. It's almost like they hired Cambridge Analytica to covertly deploy Facebook to mine our data. What are your favorites, Betsy?
I Alone Can Fix It is a classic. So is Great People on Both Sides. But I'd have to say that the military theme songs are my favorite, Rex. I Like Soldiers Who Don't Get Captured has a beautiful chorus. So does Suckers and Losers.
Ain't that the truth? But I gotta say, Betsy, some of the new songs are instant classics. Stop the Steal by Alternate State of Electors is a whale of a tune, as is Hang Mike Pence by Four Seasons Total Landscaping.
We may never bring back that time, Rex, but we'll always have this beautiful MAGA music to light the way.
Yes, Betsy. That and the Charlottesville Tiki Torches. The MAGA Years. Available on compact disc, 8-track cassette, and broken record.
And now, back to the show.
Zarina Zabriskie, welcome back to the Prevail Podcast.
Hi, Greg. Always great to talk to you.
I wanted to have you back on. I've wanted to have you back on for a while just to talk about things that are happening in Eastern Europe, because you were there recently. You were in Ukraine and you were elsewhere in Eastern Europe, and now you've returned. So you've had sort of firsthand experience on the ground. And I was just hoping before that it would be kind of hey, you know, what's going on kind of conversation. But it seems like now we're on the brink of World War III here. What's big picture? What's going on right now? I mean, it's now January 25th, so things might change when people are listening to this. But as of this moment, what's happening?
Right. And it's true that I was in Ukraine, which is Eastern Europe. Most of the time I was in Western Europe, actually. I was in Belgium, in France, and I was in something that used to be Europe and not Europe anymore, which is London, UK. And I've been going back and forth, and I was just going to go back to Odessa and Kyiv when things started to happen and they prevented me from going there. So I had to go back to the States. So what is happening, you're asking? Well, further Russian aggression against Ukraine is happening, since Russia already has invaded Ukraine in 2014 and has occupied its territory, right, annexing the peninsula of Crimea. So the war has been ongoing for the last 8 years, and there are 14,000 casualties already. And it is a war that is orchestrated by Russia with proxies that it leads, trains, supplies, finances. And it is important to be careful with words here. It's important to highlight that these are the not the Russian-backed separatists. It's incorrect, because it's not a civil war. It's the Kremlin proxy war.
Right.
So yeah. What is different now, you would ask, right?
That's what I would ask.
going on? Well, you might have heard, if you, you know, unless you have been in a massive coma or just very, you know, blessed and didn't hear anything in the last several weeks, Russia has amassed anywhere between 100,000 and 200,000, there are different data, troops, well, at least 100,000, and weaponry on Ukraine's borders. And there's now a big part being shipped to Belarus, which is on the other side of Ukraine, with the training announced in Belarus now, and then another one, big one, in the beginning of February. And the troops have been moved from Far East and Siberia, and it's an ongoing process. Like, we see the satellite pictures. I don't know if you've seen any. It's pretty scary if you look at the pictures.
Yeah, they're moving into position. So just to, I want to keep, you know, kind of going back and reviewing everything that you say, because I think it's important to really put everything that's happening now in the proper context. So Putin invaded Crimea, and he invaded Crimea is part of Ukraine historically, and certainly it was part of Ukraine after the breakup of the Soviet Union. It had been part of Ukraine for all that time. At the end of the fall of the Soviet Union, Ukraine had nuclear weapons, and they agreed in 1994 to surrender their nuclear weapons,
right,
with the understanding that A, the United States and you know, Western Europe, NATO, would help them stave off any incursion by Russia, and also with the understanding that Russia would not do that. So by invading Crimea, Putin is violating Russia's agreement with not invading Ukraine. And we, by not responding in any meaningful way, I know that there were some sanctions that were, you know, pretty right, meaningless in the grand scheme of things, but we basically sat back and let him do it. And now, you know, Crimea is like his Austria. And now this Donbass thing is like his Sudetenland, where he's like, oh no, there's people here who speak Russian, and right, there's Russians here, and we have to go in and protect them. And it's basically, if I'm reading it right, it seems to be the exact same playbook as what Hitler did in at the beginning or right before the beginning of World War II in 1939, right?
Yes, yes, they do follow Goebbels' propaganda tricks and very much Hitler's tactics. And there's actually a speech which is transcribed at the Kremlin's website in Russian and in English, where Putin says that Goebbels was a very creative person or a very talented person, something to that extent. And they certainly follow the scenario. They learn from the worst, you know.
Yeah.
There is so much significance to the annexation of the Crimea in 2014. Of course, it didn't come out of the thin air. It followed the events during which Russian puppet President Yanukovych was not following his commitment to proceed to join the EU, which the majority of population was interested in. And so there were mass protests, and that led to his ousting. And that happened in February 2014. And then right away, within a few weeks, Putin annexed the Crimea, and he prepared for it by doing what he does very well, by a disinformation and propaganda and brainwashing campaign, so that a big part of a Russian-speaking population in Crimea were talked one way or another into supporting the Kremlin policies. And then there was this fake referendum in which showed that the population of the Crimea chose to belong to Russia, which of mm-hmm. course was a total bogus.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. We should also point out in that history that the president of Ukraine at the time was the Paul Manafort client.
Exactly.
And that Paul Manafort was in Ukraine with Konstantin Kalimnik. These are characters that figure prominently in volume 5 of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on Russian interference in the 2016 election here. It's the same cast of characters. It's Paul Manafort fucking around and doing, you know, similar things, just spreading bad stuff So I think that's an important point too.
And we're not going to go there because we have a lot of like up-to-date material to cover. But if anybody is interested, I did in-depth research and I have these articles on Medium with everything you wanted and did not want to know about Konstantin Kilimnik, Manafort, and the whole gang. So just, you know, you can search. And this is on my blog on Medium. But to be, you know, a lot of things, a lot of water under the bridge, right, since then. Lots of things happened both here and there. And of course, all of this connected and all of this is going back to the 90s where you know, that's where everything has started really, or even further in history. But let's just make this jump back and see what has happened now that led to this crisis that we're having on our hands right now. One of the things that happened is that after amassing these troops at the Ukrainian border, Russia actually, the Kremlin, I should say, not Russia, the Kremlin did what they like to do. They blamed the West, the US and the EU and NATO in aggravating the situation and made an ultimatum, a written ultimatum that NATO should not accept any former USSR republics, Soviet republics, including Ukraine, as its member, and that NATO should roll back its troops from the countries that have borders with Russia or any other anti-Russian security organization in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, we'll get right on that. We'll get right on that, Putin. Yeah, but yeah, sure. Dream on, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, here we have, of course, we are just observers and I don't like passing judgments, but let's face it, the West sometimes takes a very, very soft approach with the Kremlin, and taking this written ultimatum back to the United States and giving it time to think about it, and the whole idea of coming back with the answer, with the reply, is in a way legitimizing these crazy requirements coming out of the thin air. And by the way, Navalny, the main opposition leader who is imprisoned right now in Russia, managed to get a word out of prison and addressing the West and addressing Biden. He said that this is a trap, that the West should not be responding to these ultimatums. Russia has no place of making such requirements.
Yeah, no, he's right. I mean, this is a guy that in Putin, he's just going to keep coming. You know, the one thing that we know from recent history and 20th century history is the thing that keeps the peace in the world is you're not allowed to invade a sovereign nation. And say what you will about the first Gulf War, but what happened in the first Gulf War, and I've made this point a bunch of times on this podcast, but Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. He was not allowed to do that. We told him, no, go back. He didn't. President Bush, the first Bush, gathered a coalition of allied forces and we kicked his ass out of Kuwait. And that was the end of it. And then he stopped trying to invade other countries. So had we let him invade Kuwait and keep it, God knows what happens. Maybe he's not satisfied there. Maybe he goes somewhere else. We can't know. But the fact remains that we didn't allow it to happen. And by we, I mean the entire Western world didn't allow it to happen. And therefore, his territorial ambitions were thwarted forever. So in Putin, the opposite has happened. You know, he's a guy, I think, who looks at the area around, wants to expand and recreate the Russian Empire, believes that these countries, which are sovereign countries, which are not historically part of Russia itself, but their own cultures, their own countries, he believes that they should all fall under the sway of Mother Russia. And I guess that's what he's after. But by allowing him to go into Crimea and stay there without any consequence, we have emboldened him to keep this going. Not only that, we've emboldened China to just one day they're just going to waltz into Taiwan because, hey, we didn't help Ukraine. I mean, are we really going to go to war over Taiwan? Doubtful. So, you know, it sends the way that the United States and the Western and NATO and everybody respond to these things is important. And look, nobody wants war. You know, nobody wants that. But sometimes you have to, you know, threaten these things, certainly. and not give in to the bully. You know, you have to play, use the language that the bully understands, which in his case is take his fucking money. But yeah.
Well, I completely agree with you. And of course, the history repeats itself. And history is a nightmare from which I'm trying to wake up, you know, with the words of James Joyce, you know, 100th anniversary of Ulysses. But here we, let's not just stay on the surface, because we both are writers, right? And we look, we're able to look deeper. And here we are looking at the at least a century old idea that Putin is a big fan of, and not only Putin, but say Kazakhstan's 30 years president Nazarbayev, who's currently not the president, but he's a person behind the puppet president that they have at the moment. And this idea is Eurasianism. And I wanted to talk about it a little bit because, you know, we can go through the current events, but that you can catch up listening to CNN or probably reading The Guardian that I recommend. But there are other things that sometimes fall through the cracks and they're not as obvious. And I feel like this is the value of our conversations that could be. If you look, which I did, at Putin's addresses to the Federal Assembly from the very start of his reign and until 2021 that he does every year, there is a consistent, very transparent idea that he repeats. So we can actually say that we shouldn't be blaming him for making it a secret. He's making it very obvious. It's us that who are not listening or not paying attention.
Yeah.
So what is this idea? The idea first was put together by famous linguists in the beginning of the 20th century. And basically it's the idea of creating a Eurasian state that will stretch from Lisbon to Vladivostok with the Russian nation at the core. And this doctrine has undergone quite a few transformations, at least three stages, and we're not going through it because it's very rich material. It's really interesting, actually. And I recommend Charles Clover's book, Black Snow Red Wind. He's a Financial Times chief editor, and that's the book that goes deeply and in detail into the history of this doctrine.
Snow, Red Wind. Okay.
Yeah. Charles Clover. But for the last 30 years, this idea was pushed both by Putin and by a scandalously known fascist, Alexander Dugin. You probably heard of him. Yep. Putin's brain. All right. So, but Nazarbayev has been consistently supporting this doctrine. For instance, Nazarbayev made a speech reflecting the ideas of neo-Eurasianism as early as 1994, and Putin has been on it since 2000. In 2000, he speech in Almaty, the capital at the time. Not anymore, but at the time. He said that the ideas of the age-old community, the interconnectedness of people inhabiting the vast expanses of Eurasia from the Baltic and the Carpathians, that's Ukraine, mind you, to the Pacific Ocean are alive. The instructive charge that Eurasian ideas carry is especially important today when we are building ding dong here. We are building truly equal relationship between the countries of the Commonwealth of Independent States. And we know that Nazarbayev is also supporting these ideas and the idea of the creation of Eurasian Union of States. Okay. I think this proposal said Putin has not lost its relevance. And then every year he gets back to it. Like you can just Google it, his speeches. And then in 2021, last year in December, there's like the writing on the wall. He's saying our common projects in the Eurasian Economic Union are aimed at ensuring economic goals, growth. And this is the Russian idea of the association of the states. So what he's doing here he is moving to his dream to restore the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union, in a form of this great Eurasian Union. And that includes Belarus, where currently we have the last dictator of Europe, right, Lukashenko, Russian troops training with Belarusian troops on the border of Ukraine. We have Kazakhstan, where just this month, on the 6th of January, Russian so-called peacekeepers entered to suppress the protest of the people against the 30 years of Nazarbayev's rule. And we have, if we look further, Ukraine is just a part of it. Ukraine is actually at the heart of this Eurasian community. Does it make sense, Greg?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at it on a map, I mean, Ukraine, first of all, Ukraine is a very large country in terms of just physical size. It's also, if you look at a map of Europe, it's right in the middle, which it doesn't seem like it should be when you think about Europe, but it is. And, you know, Kazakhstan and Belarus, it's just kind of almost a crescent across the territory. Kazakhstan is enormous. I think, you know, a lot of it might be, you know, sort of arid plain and stuff like that, but it's a very big country in terms of sheer territory, and it's all, you know, connected. And this also makes sense with the smaller countries in the Caucasus Mountains as well, because Russia has, you know, they have issues in Georgia, and there's the Nagorno-Karabakh, you know, conflict that's between Azerbaijan and Armenia that Russia's involved with. So there's lots of, there's trigger points all across this region. And Ukraine is really right in the middle. You know, there in Kazakhstan, if you look at the map, they're the two countries that are in the middle of it all.
And here, it's very important, everything that you're saying is critical for understanding the conflict. Because also, mind you, I actually worked in Kazakhstan at oil fields for several years, so I know the area very, very well. Yeah, I worked for at the Chevron oil field called Tengiz Chevron at Caspian Sea. So I know oil industry quite well. It was a while ago, but you know, but you know. And so Kazakhstan is very rich in oil. So of course it's a resource that Russia very reluctantly gave away when the USSR fell apart. They also have Baikonur, which is a cosmodrome, the space, which they are still using. And when we speak of Armenia and the conflict with Azerbaijan, what has happened last week, and of course nobody paid any attention because there's all these other things that are happening, but Armenian president had resigned this week after Putin called with the prime minister. And prime minister is kind of like siding up with Putin. And the president was there just for ceremonial reasons. And he was the only person that was not appointed by this prime minister. Mm-hmm. So he just suddenly resigned. And this whole incident followed the armed conflict, just like you're saying, between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the control of the Nagorno-Karabakh region, where about 6,500 people were killed in 6 weeks. And then what happened? Eventually, a Russian brokered ceasefire agreement followed. So they are peacekeeping, or say controlling, Kazakhstan area, Armenia, Azerbaijan, right there in Belarus. And now, of course, they want Ukraine. So what do you think is happening here? This whole Eurasian empire is being built just as he promised to do in his speeches.
So this is the thing that doesn't make sense. I guess, actually, I was going to ask the question, but you've already answered the question about what his motivations are. In doing this, he obviously is trying to encroach on everything sort of all at once and you know, reestablish control of these countries that were formerly part of the USSR. The Eastern Bloc countries were not. They were separate countries under the, you know, the sphere of influence, but like Czechoslovakia was not part of the USSR, but Ukraine was, Kazakhstan was, Belarus was. So, you know, and all the Caucasus Mountains countries all were.
Georgia, which also is seeking membership in the NATO, but right now they're kind of silent. And Yeah, I mean, yes, these are there are many reasons and they're complex, but this one is certainly very prominent and has been there openly, because he openly states it. It just, you know, at some point he said that nobody listened to us. Well, you listen to us now, and that's what's happening. Let's see what the guy is saying himself. But there are other reasons as well. He always had the reason of the weakening of the NATO and European Union and the US in order to become a dominant country, right, and change the balance of the powers in the world. He needs to weaken these allies' unions, and right. that's what he's doing now. There's also another important reason. In order to keep his power, he needs to drum roll the and excite the patriotism inside Russia domestically, which has always been his policy. So the siege mentality, like Russia as a country that being assaulted by the NATO and the EU and the US, and that's what the Kremlin-controlled media is pushing by you know, through the state-run channels to the public, that Russia is under the siege and that there is the external enemy that the whole Russian people should come together and fight. There's nothing like this to unite. It's like it's an age-old tactic, right?
Yeah, sure.
So that is right there.
Do you think, now you were born in the Soviet Union, you grew up there, you went to college there, so you were there long enough to you know the territory. Is it like it is in the United States, where, you know, you have basically a third of the country that's completely MAGA and brainwashed, and then a third of the country who's hip to what's going on, and then just the middle group that just blows with the wind? Or is it more than that? Like, how popular is Putin? How popular would this sort of wars be among people in Russia? Because my sense, I mean, I've met plenty of Russians in my time, and they seem to be pretty savvy people. They don't seem to be zombies by any stretch of the imagination. Now, again, the Russians that I meet are writers like you and business people and people that are traveling abroad. So maybe it's not an accurate cross section. But what is your sense of what's happening? I know you can't poll it. It's impossible to have a poll. But
well, I mean, I guess you're asking the right person, because it's a very broad question and it will probably require a separate talk. But as you know, I was forced to study the combat propaganda, the military propaganda at university. It was a classified course. I actually studied literature and languages, specializing in literature, English and American literature, at the Leningrad State University at the time. But in order to graduate, we had to take this course. And we talked about this before. We did the interview so people can look it up. And I did a lot of talks, lectures, articles covering the subject, because very few people speak openly about it, unfortunately. So I was actually forced to learn how to do this kind of brainwashing. Not that I ever did. I haven't. I never worked for the Russian state in my life, but I remember, you know, I had to pass the exam. I had to learn how to do it. And that's what other people learned how to do it and did eventually and still doing successfully. And they are very, very good at it. They are organized. They're, you know, of course, everybody has heard by now about the troll factories. And the troll factories are not only targeting the population of the enemy, as we were taught, they're also targeting the local population. And it's a massive industry. It's supported by the Kremlin. There are many, many state-held channels that are owned by Putin's close friends, childhood friends, or his youth friends. There's a conglomerate, and the millions and millions of dollars, and they are producing sophisticated content, and not so sophisticated as well, that is very successful in swaying people And the more successful they are at undermining the sense of reality in general. So there would be, you know, very simple people who didn't have the benefit of education, say. But there's also a lot of people who are educated, intelligent, savvy, like you said, but extremely cynical and believe that the whole idea of democracy is not working, and that an individual has no power, no ability to change anything, including, say, voting process. And all of this is a result of very strategic, very calculated manipulation of the consciousness. So brainwashing is a very straightforward and outdated term. But here we have a lot of machinations. And again, we spoke about it. I wrote about it at length. Somebody can Google it and read on about it. That I hope I answered your question.
No, you did. You answered my question, because it's basically what you've describing is that there's Russian Fox News, which is run by the government and obviously is very effective. I want to get back to this in a second. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Zarina Zabriskie.
You know, we had a lot of snow this week here in upstate New York, and I did not shovel the driveway properly this time. I thought my son was going to do it. He didn't do it. And what happened was it froze a lot, and now I cannot get a foot of snow out of the middle of my driveway. So this is the sort of thing you have to avoid, right? You get your car tuned up because you don't want to have big issues down the road. You get annual checkups so they nip things in the bud, and it's like that with mental health too. Going to therapy is like that. It's routine maintenance for your mental and emotional wellness to prevent bigger issues down the road, to prevent the mental health equivalent of frozen ice in the driveway of your mind. You know, these are trying times right now, guys. This is, you know, we've been traumatized for the last 5 years, and mental health is really, really, really important. So it's just essential, I think, for everybody to spend a little bit of time and a little bit of money to focus on their mental health. Going to therapy doesn't mean something's wrong with you. It means you're investing in yourself to keep your mind healthy. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. So you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Why invest in everything else and not in your mind? This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Prevail listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/Greg. That's BETTERHELP.com/GREG. BetterHelp.
Okay, we're back with Zarina Zabriskie. We were talking before the break about combat propaganda and about basically PSYOP. And so the Kremlin, through their channels, indirectly influences people in Russia, just like, frankly, they influence people here via their surrogates at Fox News and these other outlets. So you mentioned Putin's friends. Go ahead.
I do want to interfere here. And there's an important distinction.
Okay.
It's similar and it's not. Because here we have a Fox channel, but we also have other channels. We have CNN, we have CBS, and I worked for CBS at some point. We have imperfect, you know, not necessarily the coverage some people want to see. But there is a variety, and they are not run by the government. That's the main
right.
Difference here. They are not going to the White House to get their directives from the special person who runs the press. While in Russia, they go weekly to receive the guidelines, although they're trying to, of course, you know, silence it. But there's been a lot of reports showing that that's what's happening. So that's the difference. They basically, it's a military discipline, and they have the army of propagandists. That's what I was trained to do. You know, I would graduate with the officer's rank because it's a military, you know. And here the Fox correspondents, do not, they don't work for Pentagon, right?
Right. They're just informal White House advisors when Trump is president. So they do that. But no, to your point, yes, no, they do not work for the government. They don't. They're not supposed to.
They don't. Yeah. They are not funded. They are not funded by the White House.
Right.
There is a fundamental difference. And yeah, it's amazing how productive that second working mechanism is, the Kremlin mechanism. This pyramid of press going up to the Kremlin, and how efficient they are at brainwashing the population.
I was going to say, and I think maybe I'm mixing it up a little bit with the online stuff and the social media and the things that happen in other countries with the troll farms and this and that. The guy named Yevgeny Prigozhin, who's Putin's chef, was in charge of all of this stuff. He was in charge of the IRA, who were the Russians that got indicted in the Mueller report. One of the things that's interesting about that guy is that he does not have an official title in the Kremlin. He isn't, you know, the director of so-and-so. There's an ability that they have to, like, Putin can say, well, I didn't do that. You know, I didn't order that. This guy is his own company. He can do whatever he wants. And everybody knows that's a lie. But he has that level of plausible deniability that I think is important.
I don't want to sound like a broken record, but all of these figures are very important to our ongoing political process. So I have a big profile on Yevgeny Prigozhin showing how it works. So you can look it up. But, you know, I would like to bring us back.
Let's go back.
Ukrainian, because there is just so much to cover that we have several topics here. But Ukraine is on my mind because, I mean, a lot of my family was from Ukraine. I spent part of my childhood there. And even if I didn't, it's just entirely our own situation. And it's important to address it and to give as much information to people about it. One interesting reason, like we're still on the reasons, why is Putin doing it? Like today, yeah, there was a lot of talk about it, Biden, and we can't read Putin's mind. We don't know what's going on. And he's right, we can't. But with some knowledge of psychology and some experience of growing up there in the same city as he did at a different time, but nevertheless, and going to the same university as I did, we can get some educated guesses. And one of an interesting reason that I would like to bring up, again, as a writer to writer, I think we're dealing with a huge case of a death anxiety, because Putin is currently 69, turning 70, and by the Russian standards, it's old. It's not as old here in the United States and in Europe, but the life expectancy of the average man is much shorter in Russia.
Yeah.
So he's been described as a grandfather, which is the biggest insult to him. And I think we have, I don't know, have you seen the Tenet by Christopher Nolan recently?
No. I know that it's very confusing and brain trippy. So I was like, I'm not going to do that. Is it good?
Yeah.
I've heard mixed things. Yeah.
Well, it depends. It depends on what you like, of course. If you do like his films, yes. If you liked Inception, I think you would like Tenet. But the reason I'm bringing it up is because when I was watching it, and it is a mind trip, it just suddenly struck me that I'm watching the current events. This is about Putin, you know, and it starts with, I'm not going to give away things, but it starts with the explosion in Kyiv Opera orchestrated by the Russians. But there is a gun trafficking mogul who is facing his mortality and decides to use suicide to end the world. So to go with a bang. And like, oh my God, this is what we have here. It needs this attention. He either going to build up this Eurasian empire of his, or he's going to start the World War III. And when he goes, we all go.
Yeah.
Here's a script for somebody right away. But
I guess what I'm asked here, here's another question. This just popped into my head. As we know, there's always a big relationship between Putin and the mob and organized crime. And, you know, it's sometimes it's impossible to tell where one begins and the other ends. Why? I mean, do the mob want war like this? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. I feel like the people in Putin's inner circle on some level are like, what are you doing?
Yes. I mean, Putin is the mob. Russia is the mafia state and quickly becoming a mafia empire. So the mob, that's the, you know, they say that there are many countries where they have mafia, and Russia is the country where mafia has the country.
Yeah.
So do they want it? Not necessarily. And there was a good article in the Moscow Times about it today or yesterday, how the rich people in Russia, basically the oligarchs and not so rich as oligarchs, but just the middle upper middle class are suffering from this situation because speaking of the economy, I mean, this last week was a disaster for them because the investors are getting rid of their Russian assets due to the possible war and imposed sanctions. Like JP Morgan today, which is the biggest bank here, right, has completely withdrawn from the Russian ruble, closing all remaining positions in Russian currency. And as a result, the Moscow stock index fell like about 7.5%, and the Russian government debt hit the highest level. The ruble is at its lowest in 14 months, and the stock market crashed, wiping 150 billion of the value of Russian top companies. And it goes on and on because the Russian central bank stepped in, suspended the purchase of foreign currency. And of course, the business people are not happy about that. They're losing their money, and they're also losing the access to their assets parked in the West because the Western countries are now banning their travel, their visas. But with this further ongoing crackdown on the opposition, nobody is going to speak up against it because, say, just today, Navalny and many of his allies were pronounced terrorists and their bank accounts were frozen. And there's like every day there's a news of new suppression of the opposition where people either being killed or going to prison. And of course, the business class is not the one to voice their opposition under these conditions.
Yeah. But okay, well, they are feeling the strain because I feel like the one way that this is going to end without bloodshed in some way is for we really have to twist the screws with the economics. We have to be like, okay, no more SWIFT, no more leaving the country, no more your oligarchs that you have dual citizenship, get the fuck out, go home, you know, all that stuff, and make it so that the oligarchs put pressure on Putin to stop. I think without that, absent that, you got to hit him in his pocketbook.
I agree with all the above. And of course, they should switch them off the SWIFT banking system and stop Russia, ban Russia from using the dollar and so forth. But there's a big but here that oligarchs are not going to stop Putin. That's not how the dynamics there, that they cannot do anything about it. The way the power works there, he's the one who's going to decide on this ultimate suicide, and nobody's going to stop him, unfortunately.
I mean, but you know, it's like the old emperors of Rome. They were the emperors of Rome until the Praetorian Guard got sick of them, and then they were dead and they were no longer emperor, you know. So I don't know what the inner workings are, but he doesn't appear to have been coming from a position of strength. Certainly in the last year or so, he seems to be coming from a position of weakness. And I would argue that this little misadventure is indicative of that weakness. It's like he needs something to break for him in order to, you know, make people like him again or believe in him again or secure more power. I don't know.
No, because that's the difference in mentality, Greg. And I'm very happy we're talking about this because you're thinking, thank God for that, like the Western person. You have the American mentality. The democracy is built into you. You think that he needs people to like him in order to be reelected. He doesn't. because the elections are senseless, meaningless there. They are fabricated and always have been. He doesn't need the ratings.
No, but he needs the people. When I say the people, I mean the people in the circle. I mean the oligarchs. I mean the, you know, the generals in the army, like the people. There are people in Russia who have power. Igor Sechin, people like that, you know, you know, they're friends of his and stuff like that, but they're also all criminals. So I don't know.
They are. Igor Sechin went to the same school and he's been tied up and they are all dependent. There is this Kruговая Порука, the mutual responsibility principle, where they all one way or another compromised and basically under his control. And there's also the way the money distribution is organized. There's this thing called Obshchak, which is a communal fund, which oligarchs, they have their money, and yet then it's the money is not entirely theirs. It's very sophisticated. And that's why it's so hard to get rid of Putin, because otherwise, yes, they would have gotten rid of him a long time ago. But so far, I do, at least, and you know, I'm just a private person who's been reading and writing about it for a long time and lived there. But in my opinion, we are not going to get rid of him anytime soon unless there's a miracle, and I don't believe in miracles. So yeah, I guess I'm not sounding too optimistic here.
That's not, well, if it might not be the time for optimism. I mean, this is definitely a scary thing. By the time this runs, we might be at war. You know, I might have to run it early because
the situation changes every day. I follow the events and I have the whole spiel I can give you about what has happened today in terms of the, you know, firearms delivering the weapons and the troops redistribution and which country promises what in terms of help, helping Ukraine. But it changes like not even on the daily basis, on the hourly basis. And we are facing a very dangerous situation because what people in the West, I think, still don't understand how badly this situation will influence us in the West. There are so many factors, like Ukraine, for example, supplies food to Africa and Asia, a lot of the region there. And so the war will cause the crisis and price changes throughout the world. Then the oil prices will be affected. Then, of course, there's the whole question of the gas, the pipeline.
Yeah, Germany, sure.
Not just Germany, we actually, you know, we also have a fracking issue and the Keystone pipeline and the oil prices going up and down. But you're right, of course, the Nord Stream 2, the pipeline, is one of the most important factors here. And it's important to know to our listeners that EU, on the one hand, accounts for about one third of the Russian trade and is the biggest market for natural gas, and it's the biggest investors on the one hand. But on the other hand, the EU relies on Russia to support about 40% of the natural gas and 25% of oil. And especially for Germany, this relationship is important because basically, Russia is its main supply of gas. And if Russia cuts down the gas, then Germany is going to freeze in the middle of the winter. But luckily, today there came the news that the Biden's administration is now discussing the production of liquefied natural gas.
Right.
Being underwritten to Europe with many countries, not to say that we are producing quite a bit of liquefied natural gas. And there's Qatar. So many factors to consider.
I know. It's very, very complicated and it's scary. I can tell you look like tired and scared a little bit. You do. You're not, you know.
I have been. And so, I have a lot of friends in Ukraine in the writing community and publishing community and just friends from all sort of communities. And I've been talking to people nonstop, and it breaks my heart because, you know, I'm talking to middle-aged housewives who are packing their backpacks to go to army and fight with AKs in their hands. And I'm talking to people who are packing their dogs to flee to Romania from Kiev. I mean, it just is horrifying and heartbreaking. And they already have been through so much, you know, starting from the time when Yanukovych was ousted from Maidan, and then the war, and then annexation of Crimea, and then COVID, and now this.
Yeah, it's been, and the government that was set up, you know, after the fall of the Soviet Union was enormously corrupt. Lots of money was stolen from the public coffers and just left the country completely, never to return. Yeah, it's been difficult. And, you know, we have not had a major war in Europe in quite some time. I mean, I know there's been skirmishes in the Balkans in the 90s, but, you know, since the end of World War II, we've been very, very, very lucky. It's been a historical anomaly to have that much peace over that much territory for this long. And, you know, this is the way things used to always be. And hopefully, you know, the cooler heads will prevail here. We'll be able to get out of this without terrible things happening. But it doesn't seem likely that certainly in Ukraine itself, it's going to be bad. I mean,
No. And I was there. It was beautiful. This is an amazingly beautiful city. The architecture is to die for, literally, you know, with the AK in your hands or not, but it's just fantastic. And with so much history and culture, the museums there, the theaters is great, the food and people are so warm and lovely. And I was writing there for a month. I just got away and I was writing there at a small attic and walking every evening. And there was celebration every night. I arrived right at the 30th anniversary of independence. And people were so happy wearing this bright yellow, like golden yellow and blue. And there were fireworks and music everywhere. And they're so happy to be independent. And on the other hand, you walk down the street and you see the memorials to the young people who, both men and women who were killed in the war. And you see a lot of people in camouflage and uniform and military centers. And this is a country that is in the state of war. And it's unusual for us, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't seen it. Nobody our age has really, you know, seen it in Europe. I know, I understand there's been wars that people have participated in, but not in this way. This is a new thing. If this escalates in any kind of meaningful way, it could get really bad really quickly, like World War I level tangled alliances. Oh shit. And it's scary. And you know, it's all because this one guy, it's really a madness that this guy is still around. So, you know, I'm rooting for COVID. Maybe there'll be a new strain. I don't know.
I mean, I assure you that he is vaccinated. I mean, his troll factories are disseminating the anti-vaccine campaigns, but
walking around in a hazmat suit. He wasn't fucking around. I mean, he was by himself. He was in the whole thing. He was not going to let it take him out. I mean, you know, he took it very, very seriously for himself personally. That was pretty obvious. I'm going to pivot out of this, but do you have any more things to add about Ukraine before we?
Yeah, well, I just want to add that, you know, when we think about the war, and you mentioned the World War One, and of course, there's this rich history in World War Two. In fact, my ancestors were killed by the Nazis in Ukraine, shot dead, you know, and there's all this, and that would be happening too. There are people already in the trenches and there are people dying, but there also, we are in 2022. So there will be other types of war. There would be asymmetric hybrid war, and we should keep that in mind just to know how serious it is. And it would be everything from something seemingly innocent like lawfare, with like when law is being used as weapon. And yeah, it's already happening because Yanukovych just yesterday, he applied to the administrative court in Kyiv regarding his illegal detention of his authority. And they scheduled the hearing in February, so kind of legitimizing his claim to the presidency, which gives Russian propagandists such a great tool already to operate on people's minds. And from there, we have cyber attacks, right? And they can turn off infrastructures. And today, actually, three countries, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan, for the whole day were turned off the electric grid. They didn't have power, they didn't have internet. And during this appraisal in Kazakhstan, people didn't have connection. They didn't have internet and you couldn't reach them by phone either. So this is another way of fighting the war. And there's also things like airspace, which today was a good article in the defense, the Minister of Defense newspaper, which is a great resource, by the way, that Russia can just do one elegant move by banning the Western air flight from entering their airspace.
Yeah,
that will dramatically change the whole dynamics, you know, both cargo and passenger fleet. And you go on and on and on. It's like it's a completely different reality than we live it in now. And of course, what is the conclusion to all of this? That we all should be aware and we should demand our governments to do everything to prevent this situation one way or another.
Yeah, it's really scary. You know, it's terrifying. I mean, we've had the one thing that we managed to avoid in the Trump years is a big war. You know, I think that was something everybody was afraid of. And, you know, maybe Putin wanted Trump to do it and he didn't. And I don't know, but it's looking it's looking bleak at the moment. And hopefully, you know, even by the time this runs, it'll be less bleak and not more bleak. You know, that's my hope. So, okay, I don't want to end this on a bad note because I feel like now we just went. So I'm going to go back. I'm changing the subject entirely.
Yes.
You mentioned before you did a project or a video thing about James Joyce's Ulysses, which is 100 years now, right? The publication of it is 100 years.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about what that was all about, because I happen to be a fan of James Joyce and Ulysses, and I want to hear about it.
Oh yeah, sure. That's a pleasure to talk about.
Okay.
I really don't like talking about the hybrid war propaganda. In fact, I hate it. And again, I studied literature. I'm a writer. I make literature. I ran a bookstore, and I currently still run a literary channel for bookstore in San Francisco. It's a charming little bookstore, independent, 50 years old. Really like a best hidden secret in San Francisco, right by the Golden Gate Park. And I run the YouTube channel called Globus Books. And I do literary shows that I started in the beginning of COVID because we all were stuck at home. And you, Greg, you were running these programs. And I was doing a lot of interviews with writers, literary translators, poets, artists. And it really kept me going during the COVID. It was fun. Most of our shows are in English, and we covered a lot of Russophone literature, or Ukrainian literature, or Eastern European literature, but not only. We had open mics with Paris in Spanish and French. It was just a lot of fun, especially if you happen to like this sort of things. And recently, because you're right, it's the 100th anniversary of Ulysses on the 1st of February, which is also James Joyce's birthday. So we did a couple, and still doing a couple of shows. There was one in English that I really recommend around the new book that recently came out of the Cornell University Press about James Joyce in Russian literature by Jose Vergara, who was one of the people on the panel. And then we had a couple of very, very popular Russian writers and the most popular video blogger in Russia. He's a top one Forbes literary blogger. Fascinating stuff. So you can just look for it. And, you know, like, of course, everything repeats. Like we did say that history is the nightmare I'm trying to wake up from in the word of, you know, Stephen Dedalus.
Dedalus, yeah.
Yeah, in Ulysses. But then, you know, of course, the Ulysses is based on the Odyssey by Homer. And when you go back, you know, and you reread it, which I did recently, and it was so delightful, you know. But on the other hand, you know, all these wars, you know, and I was thinking to myself, you know, Trojans are like Russians these days, you know, with their Trojan horse being the propaganda of the viruses and stuff. You find so much parallels. Of course, you know, Ulysses by Joyce was written at the time of the World War I, and you can feel that too in the, say, the issues of anti-Semitism that are very prevalent, one of the main leitmotif in Ulysses. They are the same. They didn't change very much. As I was rereading Ulysses, we had the you know, synagogue being attacked in Texas. But at the same time, literature handles the eternal human condition matters in a different way, and it's certainly more delightful for me to address the reality through literature than through sometimes, you know, current events.
Well, the current events are certainly, they're certainly depressing. I'm the kind of reader I am. You're way more high class than I am in terms of this stuff. I'm just going to say right off the bat, you read a lot more, you know, a lot more than I do. What I like to do is I like to read a long book every once in a while so that I can brag about it and make it seem like I'm better read than I am. But Ulysses, I read a couple of times because I like the idea that it's all set in one day. I like things that are all set in one day, especially something that long and intricate, and there's all these crossing paths. And it's a very difficult book to read if you're not like reading it with some sort of note or help. But what's amazing about him is his voice. I mean, he's such a good writer. Just the voice is so strong and so powerful when he's writing in quote unquote lucid Joyce that it's just really amazing to read. And I don't know. I always enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea of finishing up with on the literary note. And what I can recommend, if you're not very familiar, say, with Ukraine or Ukrainian culture, I recommend reading Gogol, Nikolai Gogol, and his early short stories, that the evenings at the farm by Dikanka, and they translated very, very well. And the pure fun, it's kind of like with Edgar Allan Poe touch with, you know, like, but also very funny, great language with a lot of, you know, like devilish touch. And you can catch some of the atmosphere and the traditions and the idea of Ukraine as it was and as it is.
Okay, so is that Dead Souls? Is that the book?
Dead Souls is already happening in Russia, not in Ukraine.
So it's earlier than that. Okay.
Yeah, because he moved to St. Petersburg and then he lived in Italy. Dead Souls is great and I recommend it too, but it's more epic and probably requires more time and concentration and is not necessarily about Ukraine. But the evenings at the Stead Farm by the Dikanka, just looked up, Google up evenings.
Google.
Google. Yeah.
Google.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no, my whole theory about Ulysses is Joyce just wanted to write about sex, and he had like four pages that he just wanted to include, but he couldn't publish it that way. So he had to write this entire half unreadable book to disguise all of the dirty shit that he wanted to say. That's it. That's my theory of Ulysses. If that doesn't get people to read it, I don't know what will. Zarina, we can find you. We can find you on Twitter. You're at Zarina Zabriskie. You have a website, and you know, you have a great Medium page. There's a lot of really great things there. I've interviewed you on Prevail before, and you've been on the podcast before. But also, your journalism is really, really, I think, you extremely useful to me to understand how all this stuff works. And I look forward to the time when we don't have to worry about this little shit Putin anymore. And we could just talk about your novel and my novel and not have to worry about the world ending. That would be nice.
Years to that, Greg. That so looking forward to that. And it's so much appreciative of what you are doing, really, and what you have done all this time and the time and energy that you sacrifice, I know, taken away from your own writing, from your own literary career to do this. So useful to everyone. And I think everybody else will join me in thanking you for this.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Coming from you, it's really a compliment. And I mean that sincerely. It's you know, I have the world of respect for you, as you know. So
likewise, mutual.
Zarina, thank you so much for joining me. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Greg.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sofia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signet Della, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
Ask Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off Duration and SuperDeck products May 17th through the 20th. That means 30% off our most popular color family, blue. Psychologists have found it to be soothing and relaxing, which makes it especially great for bedrooms and bathrooms. And of course, get 30% off all of our other colors. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.